Hi, and welcome to Dr. Scott Gray's Redefining Physical Therapy podcast for orthopedic, sport, and manual physical therapists, delivering practical and real-life content and strategies for busy clinicians. Here is your host and expert physical therapist, Dr. Scott Gray.
All right, welcome everyone to the next episode of the Redefining Physical Therapy podcast. And so today we have an awesome guest on the podcast, and this is someone that I can consider my mentor, and he's one of the main reasons why I got into physical therapy. So without further ado, I want to introduce Mr. Bill Hartman. And so before I let Bill speak here, I want to tell everyone a little bit about Bill. So Bill has over 25 years of experience. He is a physical therapy by trade, but he also is an awesome performance coach. He is the owner of IFAST Physical Therapy and Sports and Conditioning. He is an author, international speaker, and he is one of the U.S. leading PTs. So without further ado, please welcome Mr. Bill Hartman on the podcast today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Scott. I appreciate it.
So Bill, why don't you tell our audience a little bit some things maybe I didn't talk about. What made you get into PT about 25 years ago?
Anything else to do at the time. So I was working on my master's degree in exercise phys, and I was slowly turning into this lab rat where I was spending ridiculous hours, you know, sitting in a lab watching people run on treadmills and ride bikes and, you know, measuring things through the metabolic cart, and it was very draining. It wasn't interesting to me at the time, and having, you know, always been on the sports side of things and the fitness side of things and the training side of things, I was already working as a personal trainer way back then. So this would be 1988, I think, and so it just seemed like a way to take what I was already interested in and being able to apply it in some way, shape, or form. And so literally I just started applying to PT schools at the time and got into it and just slowly evolved over the last 27 years. So I'm going on 27 years now, you know, just trying to get better every day.
Yep. I think that's one thing I took from you with my time mentoring you is, you know, you're always evolving your thought process and your assessment, your treatment, and you're always trying to further yourself. So I think that's something I think all PTs can take from you, something I've learned tremendously from. So Bill, go ahead. Let's talk a little bit about your case today. So you have a 14-year-old volleyball player. And now, was this obviously a female, I'm assuming?
Yes.
Okay, so why don't you tell our audience a little bit about the subjective history of this patient?
So I got to tell you, this girl is an animal when it comes to being an athlete. So we've known her since she was 10 years old, and she could knock out a perfect set of 10 chin-ups as a 10-year-old. So quite the athlete. But just like, you know, I always compare athletes like her to like superheroes that don't know how to control their superpowers. And, you know, the things that make her great are the things that can destroy her. And so she can really push herself hard. And so, you know, she never has trouble with an on switch. So she started to develop this progressive lower back pain through her high school season. So she's a freshman. That actually started on varsity and obviously got pushed very, very hard, you know, being one of the younger athletes. So developed some progressive extension-based back pain. She's very comfortable lying in supine. She doesn't experience any pain at nighttime. But anytime that she's challenged with a high-intensity activity or develops some level of fatigue, she becomes quite painful. And so again, anything extension based, so you think about serving a volleyball or any, you know, extensive overhead reaching, such as a setting or whatever, she's going to be reinforcing that extension-based pattern. That's where she gets a lot of her pain. We'll wake up occasionally with back pain as well, but she didn't show any peripheralized symptoms, nothing that would point towards anything that neurologically related, if you will, that would warrant some, you know, extensive concern over nerve root issues or peripheralization. So that's basically where we started.
Now, was it more unilateral or was it pretty centralized?
Primarily left-sided, but I mean, with an extension-based kind of a concept here, she's going to be close to central. Not really a major concern for me. I fully expect, based on the model that I work from, that we're going to see a little bit more left-sided extension-based activity in general. Just being a human, we're going to see that. So this is no surprise for me. The concern that I have is with her is, how well does she manage it? This is not something that's going to disappear. What this becomes is a management process. And then, making sure that she's able to maintain her ability to extend. She's going to have to extend. So we don't want to take that away from her. We just want to be able to manage it and make sure it's not painful.
Sure. All right. So based on your, I was just going through some of your objective tests that I saw that you sent me. So I was going to go ahead and kind of read those and then sure. To the audience. And then maybe we'll let you kind of describe, why you tested some of those things and why you kind of went that route with your exam. So just off the bat, I see she's got limited left shoulder flexion, about 5 to 10 degrees, limited shoulder horizontal abduction on the left, and left shoulder external rotation limited. She was positive for limitation passive hip abduction on the right, a wide infrasternal angle, and she had a limited rotation into thoracic rotation to the left.
Yep.
So maybe you just, Bill, kind of take us through your assessment process kind of overall. I think it's a little bit different than your typical physical examination. So maybe just talk about that first, and then we'll get into some of your findings.
Right. So Scott, what I'm doing with my examination, so I don't care what the diagnosis is. I don't evaluate parts. I evaluate humans. And so I evaluate position. And using the appendicular skeleton mobility and movement to identify the axial skeleton position and movement. And so what this does is it just tells me how this person is managing their ability to move through space and manage the pressures inside of their body, right? And so if you think about put anyone in a stressful situation, and if you challenge any system of the body, it will reduce its degrees of freedom. So if we look at blood pressure, right? If I stress you out, blood pressure goes up, and it will tend to remain elevated until the stressor is alleviated. If I leave that stressor on long enough, I'll get peripheral adaptations that will stabilize blood pressure at a higher level. So now I have a more stable blood pressure, but it is elevated. So the movement system is very similar in that respect. So what I have is a person that's exposed to repeated stressors. And so this athlete is going to try to reduce her degrees of freedom to help her manage the stress. And so the easiest way to do that is to shift her center of gravity forward and begin to function in a much more extended position. And so that's what I'm measuring here with her assessment. If you look at the numbers that I gave you, you'll see that she's actually very symmetrical. Although there's some differences, certainly she's very symmetrical. So she's got extension going through her system from top to bottom, right? And this extension is actually occurring above the pelvis, so it's in the spine above the pelvis. So the pelvis is now oriented. It's oriented into a position where a lot of people would call that an anterior tilt, but it's not a tilt in the pelvis itself. It's above the pelvis, which is why she's got this wide infrasternal angle. So when I extend the spine above the pelvis, I have to extend the thorax. As I extend the thorax, the infrasternal angle is going to widen based on the pull of internal obliques, pecs, and such. And so what I have now is a person that cannot manage the pressures inside of her body. So I have a descended diaphragm. I have abdominal muscles that can't contribute to controlling the rib cage and allow the diaphragm to function as an effective respiratory muscle. If it's always descended, then I have somebody that's typically hyperinflated. So think about putting all of your air into the lower anterior rib cage, right? And if I can't move that air pressure out of there, I have somebody that cannot bend forward. So I cannot flex. Now, she can touch her toes, but then the question becomes, what's the qualitative aspect of that measure? Is like, can she reverse her lumbar curve? And she can't. Mm-hmm. So everything that she does, she's already in an extended posture. So she's limited her degrees of freedom to allow her to manage whatever stressors she's exposed to. And then this starts to interfere with her ability to access all of her movement options. So that's what we're measuring when we're doing this evaluation. And that's why you evaluate the whole human. Because again, we have to use the appendicular skeleton to help us identify what that axial skeleton is actually capable of. And so again, that's what we're looking at with the evaluation.
So to sum that up, basically for our audience out there, you know, you're seeing a lot of this extension pattern because people can't deal with the local stresses, whether it be daily life, sport, recovery, and so they fall within this extended based posture, right? So they get anti-gravity tone, and it creates a cascade and limits her mobility. And obviously, she's stuck in extension, so when she has mechanical back pain in that extended position.
Right. So yeah. So just as we would say, she's just living in extension. She utilizes it. The system learns that it's an easier way for her to manage. And it's always going to be cumulative stress. You know, it's never going to be one thing. We can't ever isolate out, you know, any one particular thing. All systems are integrated. So in essence, I have no idea why, you know, she's extended. So I don't worry about that. What I want to do now from a treatment perspective is not to sort of achieve an ideal of any kind. What I want to do is to restore the variability back to the system to make her more adaptable. She's given up adaptability to manage what she is experiencing, whether it be physical, psychological, cognitive, however you want to look at it. And so now we're going to move to treatment. And again, my goal is not to try to achieve some ideal posture, some ideal movement. What I want to do is I want to restore all of her movement options that should be available to her, and then let her system figure out the rest.
That's great. I think, you know, there's a lot of different movement people out there that think that there's one way to move, and I like that you said just giving her variability and options, you know, because as in sport, you know, you're going to be into some different positions in all three planes, and you need to have that variability to for the system to get in and out. Otherwise, as you know, your options are limited. You're going to be stuck in a position, and you know, there goes an injury, right?
Right. So, or not necessarily an injury, Scott. You know, we don't want to. And again, injury is such an ill-defined concept. But all we're dealing with here is an unpleasant situation, right? And you know, to alleviate pressure, tension, load on a specific structure that the brain is going to recognize, and it's going to say, you know what, take the pressure off of this, and so it's going to make it hurt. But what if you can't take the pressure off because you don't know how to manage, you know, the stressors? You don't know how to shift pressures inside your body to allow you to access motions. So again, we don't ever want to try to achieve an ideal. The thing that I always teach my students is like, okay, so if there is an ideal, how do you know when you're there? I mean, what's your measurement? We right. don't have a measurement.
Right.
You know, we talk, you know, I hear therapists talking about neutral postures. Well, prove to me that you're there. I mean, right. there's no way to tell. So in essence, let's get that thought process out of our heads and let's talk about restoring the normal variability to a system and then allow the system to adapt to the environment and to the task. And that is usually the only solution that we can provide because, again, pain is just one of those outputs from the brain. We need an adaptable system and then let the chips fall where they may as we move people through graded exposures and such to allow them to return to their normal activities.
Sure. So, Bill, maybe let's talk a little bit about your objective test now. I'm assuming, you know, this is pretty common pattern that you see with the extended posture. So obviously you kind of alluded about the infrasternal angle, but maybe talk about that left shoulder. Why is that left shoulder really limited compared to the right? And what was your kind of your thought process behind that?
Which limitation you want to talk about there, buddy?
The flexion. So we'll start with the shoulder flexion there.
Sure. I mean, my shoulder flexion is mildly limited, but let's consider something. I have somebody that's laying in supine as I'm measuring this, and they're also most likely extended. The thorax and spinal position are extended, and so I'm just using that as a representation of you know, again, what is the axial skeleton doing? So if I see a limitation in the ability to move overhead, and this is a passive motion, my assumption is not that I have some sort of crazy shoulder limitation of any kind, but I look at the contributions of the entire thorax and the relationships between the thorax and the spine and the pelvis as far as what would be limiting it. And I'm not even concerned about which structure it is. I mean, you can argue that it's going to be this muscle or that muscle, but what that's telling me is that I've got a little bit more of an extension pattern on the left side than I do on the right side. And this is not a shocker to me. You know, we know we're asymmetrical beings and we tend to extend a little bit more on the left side anyway. If you look back in all the osteopathic literature extending back into the early 1900s, you're going to see this type of patterning identified. So again, as far as my mental model is concerned for a human, this is not unusual, but it does provide me a window into what this system is actually trying to do as far as a management strategy. And so again, the shoulder flexion is just it gives me a measure of sagittal position, if you will, that I'm going to have a little bit more extension on one side than the other.
Sure. Okay. So your thought process was I'm a little bit more extended on the left. So.
Yeah. What? I mean, yeah. I'm not gonna weigh one measure more than any other. What you have to do, and again, that we don't want to become isolative in our thought process here because everything is integrated. All these movements are integrated. All three planes are in play here. This is one small measure that has to be integrated with all the other measures because you're going to look, you know, you look down the evaluation itself and you're going to see other areas that are limited. Like, and she's limited on both sides, you know, to a degree. And so again, we have to take that stuff into consideration as well.
So yeah, let's talk about that. What other things did you find during that from your objective test?
Sure. Well, again, so first and foremost, it's like the inability to adduct. So the inability for the hips to cross midline is associated with a position of the acetabulum as it is oriented. It's a retroverted position of the acetabulum that will limit the ability to adduct the hip. And so that provides an element of orientation of, again, what you're looking at from the pelvis. And then on up as you go, you know, you can use your shoulder flexion measurement like we talked about before. And then you're going to look at how does she manage pressures inside of her body. So that's going to be a respiratory related scenario. So then we look at infrasternal angle to provide us an element of diaphragmatic position. As far as her ability to achieve a normal respiratory cycle, and if the diaphragm is descended and she is a hyperinflated individual, which she is, which means she puts a lot of air pressure into the anterior lower rib cage, we're going to see a reduction in air pressure into the upper rib cage, and so when that happens, you're going to have a reorientation of the sternum and the upper rib cage, which is going to position the scapula as such that it's going to limit the ability to internally rotate the shoulders. And you can see that she's limited bilaterally in that regard. Mm-hmm. Now, if you consider the constraints of the upper thorax, so we're looking at the true ribs, if you will, so 2 through 7 plus the sternum and the upper thoracic spine, when you think about the constraints of that area of the thorax, I've got a lot of transverse plane capability there. And so I should see a fair amount of rotation in the upper thorax, but but if you look at her horizontal abduction measure, which is a great measure to utilize to identify whether that upper thorax can rotate, you're going to see limitations on both sides. Because what I'm looking for there is something in the 30 plus range to give me a normal measure, if you will, and she's going to be limited on both sides. So now I have an upper thorax that doesn't rotate either, which makes total sense to me, because if I have an extended system, as I, and this, you know, this is like basic ortho 101 stuff, that if I shift somebody into one plane more so than the others, I'm going to steal motion in all planes. So if I have an extended human being, I'm going to see a limitation in rotation. And so again, we see that in her standing rotation, we see that in her seated rotation, and then we see that in the upper thorax rotation based on her horizontal abduction measure. So again, that's what all of these measures together will tell me, is that I have an extended human being, but you can't rely on just one simple measure.
Sure. Now, Bill, talk a little bit about her, I think it was her right hip. You had a positive hip abduction limitation. Can you maybe talk about, I'm assuming the extended base posture is going to limit and change the orientation of the acetabulum, allowing that hip hip mobility?
We're talking about the right hip abduction?
I think that's what you said. Yeah, that's what I've seen on your thing. Yep.
So, yeah, so I have a difference there. And so what that indicates to me, Scott, is that even though I have an extended human being that has moved forward in the sagittal plane, I also have somebody that is right lateralized. Okay, so in stance, she's going to be shifted to the right a little bit more. And so what you're going to see in that scenario is you're going to see more adduction activity on the right side than the left side. So again, it just from a modeling standpoint, we're left brain dominant, controls the right side of the body. And so as I have a human that is defending itself or assuming a defensive posture, and I'm going to see the limitation of degrees of freedom, I'm also going to see him shift him to the right.
Sure.
And then get a normal occurrence that I'm going to see under most situations with an extended posture.
Sure. All right. So now, Bill, let's talk a little bit about your breathing assessment. So obviously the diaphragm position, they have it hyperinflated in this individual. What kind of tests are you looking at far as with her, watching her breathe? Are you looking just for more of a qualitative standpoint? If her rib cage can move in all three planes, what are you looking for in that regard?
Infrasternal angle is going to give you a great deal of information as to what position the diaphragm is in. With a wide infrasternal angle like she was demonstrating, if you think about the bucket handle activity of the thorax that we typically talk about in the lower rib cage, what we're looking at is that she is in an inhalation position, which would be a descended diaphragm. So right away, I know where she is capable of putting air inside of her thorax, which would be the anterior lower aspect of the thorax. And this is actually the path of least resistance for humans in general because of gravity and our structure. But in this case, if I have the wide infrasternal angle and she's driving airflow anterior inferior, then I know that I'm not going to get it into the superior aspect of the thorax. Again, I can rely on my shoulder motion assessment to help me identify the position of the upper rib cage, the capabilities of the upper rib cage, therefore again, limitations in the movement position of the scapula, therefore the movement and position of the humerus will be limited as well. So I don't need to do an extensive, observational type of an assessment, although there are many different ways to do that if you need to, if you're questioning things. In her case, just using that infrasternal angle can start to drive your treatment as to what needs to be done.
Okay. So speaking of that, so let's move along a little bit into your treatment. So obviously, you know, off your objective findings, you see a lot of extended-based symptoms and patterns. How are you getting that infrasternal angle down? How are you getting air out of her lungs?
Okay, so this is just a little bit of simple cueing and breathing retraining, if you will. Again, I want to emphasize that I'm not looking for some sort of magical, ideal type of breathing. What I want her to be able to do is to access the extremes of inhalation to exhalation. And then if that's available to her, then she has all positions in between. So it just stands to reason, right? If I have the two extremes, then I can fill the gaps. So if I'm starting with a wide infrasternal angle, what I want is somebody that can actually close that infrasternal angle. So if we think about anatomy for a second as to, you know, what muscles have the advantage to close that infrasternal angle, I'm looking at external obliques. And so from a breathing perspective, what I'm going to do then is I'm going to have her drive her exhalations a little bit more aggressively because I need to recruit those external obliques and being a much more superficial muscle, they're a little bit harder to recruit, especially when they're in a position where they're at length. And so what we do is we do a little bit more aggressive exhalation and a little bit more prolonged. And the way that I would describe it for you, I don't have the study handy to talk about this, but as far as recruitment of the abdominal muscles in regards to how you would exhale, the way I describe it is with a relaxed open mouth, as if you were trying to fog up the world's biggest window with your breath. Hmm. We don't want to create a lot of high pressure at the mouth because what that will do – I'm sorry, let me reverse that. I do want to create some pressure at the mouth, my bad, because I do want to recruit the external obliques. Sorry, I was thinking about somebody else for a second. I do want to create a little bit of pressure at the mouth. So we are going to do like a pursed lip exhalation. I might even use a balloon to create some resistance to close that infrasternal angle. So basically, she's in supine. We'll put her in like a hook lying position, and we just literally start to coach the breathing, teach her how to get a full exhalation, a little bit more aggressive, like I said, and then once she is capable of doing that, then we can move on to some form of activities to start to work on changing the muscle activity that is limiting her capabilities. Sorry about the confusion there.
Sure.
Let me just review real quick as far as the exhalation goes. When I have a wide infrasternal angle, I want a much more aggressive type of an exhalation, and I do want to create resistance at the mouth, so it would be like a pursed lip exhalation.
Okay, yep, that clarifies it. Now, you start kind of more supine hook lying. What would be like a progression? I mean, you increase sets and reps and resistance, or you then change position to put more load on the, you know, how do you go about progressing that progression?
Mm-hmm. So we want to. So first rule: always put people in a position where they can be successful, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what I have is a person that when she's standing, she's battling position, right? So she wants to extend, she wants to push pressure forward in her body. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put her in a very supported, simple position. So I can put her on her back, put her feet up into a heel supported position on a bench, 90 degrees of knee bend. And what that does right away is it helps reduce some of that extension through the system. If I have her push her heels down on a bench, I get some hip extension activity, which is going to help me rotate the pelvis posteriorly, because again, she's oriented forward. So I want to orient that pelvis posteriorly. And so now I have the hip extensor muscles that can help reduce some of that extensor activity above the pelvis, and then I drive the exhalation. And so the first activity that we actually did with her was to help her to recruit those external obliques even further by doing an overhead reach, like you would with a pullover mm-hmm. position, if you will. So we'll give her a little light weight in her hands, and then she can reach back overhead about 45 degrees. And so she's in this heels elevated position with her feet on a bench. She pulls down, get the hamstrings and that the part of the glute max that attaches to the posterior femur there to help her posteriorly rotate the pelvis, inhibit the low back. And then by reaching overhead, I put those external obliques on a little bit of stretch, which allows her to recruit them a little bit more effectively as she exhales aggressively.
I like it. Okay, very nice. So now I'm assuming after you kind of fix some of the breathing issues that this shoulder mobility increased, the trunk rotation increased, So maybe talk a little bit about that. I think a lot of people sometimes get caught up and they think everything's biomechanical and we'll just mobilize the crap out of these joints. But it sounds kind of like you kind of look at the thorax position, which is changed based off the diaphragm. You change that, then everything kind of frees up. Am I right?
Correct. So we have to understand the constraints of the system, right? So way back in PT school, we all learned about the different types of joints and how they move, and we can't forget those things because those provide us with what the movement options should be. But we have to also understand that not everybody is starting from this perfect position that provides the most movement options available to us. And so if I reorient the sockets, I'm going to either promote motion in a direction or I'm going to reduce motion in a direction. And so a lot of times when we can alter the pressures inside the thorax, shift the pressure inside the abdomen, what we get is a reorientation of the hip sockets and the glenoid, and what that allows us to do is immediately free up motion because now I have a reduction of muscle tone that I don't need anymore, and I have provided them with movement options. So I have actually restored the movement variability to the system, and so we typically see a change in the appendicular measures. And again, that's why we use those measures to identify the axial position. So that's how I know when we're making an effective change. Sure. That doesn't negate the manual therapies that we were taught. I look at this from a hierarchy perspective. If you look at something that affects the entire system as your primary go-to, a lot of times we don't need the manual therapies, but there are situations that if I look at something that is a systemic effect, like respiration and such, and I don't do the changes that I need, then maybe I do need a more local stimulus to get the effect that I want. So we don't negate any treatment, and we have to consider these people as their own within subjects design. Some people, just appear to carry a little bit more protective capabilities, and therefore their muscle tone might be a little bit higher, or they have learned over time a much stronger pattern or position, and so maybe we need a little bit of a local mobilization. So I don't negate that stuff. I still do occasionally maybe some soft tissue or some joint mobs or whatever I need to do to stimulate the system and get a window of opportunity and mobility. But a lot of times when you do these systemic related activities, you just don't need to do that.
I like that answer, Bill. I think a lot of times someone's so far in one camp versus the other. And I think, the breathing and stuff is just one tool in your toolbox. And you can't forget, some of our traditional stuff as PTs. It's just, as you said, it can kind of help expedite the process if they're not getting what you want with, as you kind of said, with your retraining. So that's a great point. Now, one last thing here in regards to your treatment here, Bill. I noticed in your initial eval you had 10 degrees of hip internal rotation bilaterally. But uh-huh. Then after treatment, you had about 30. And so maybe talk about this. I think as PTs, if we were to evaluate that hip, we would have saw symmetrical. We would have said, okay, yeah, that's their normal. Tell me why you went after. Did the hip just free up from the retraining of the breath? Talk about that.
So initially, yes. Yeah. So let's look at this for again. So what we're doing, like I said, we're looking at an individual as their own within subjects design, right? So we perform an intervention, and then as soon as we perform an intervention, we immediately have to retest some of our measures to identify whether the intervention was effective, right? Mm-hmm. And so as we do the respiratory activities, as we do some of the physical activities to improve recruitment of certain muscle groups and reduce the activity of some of the muscle groups. So we have concentrically oriented muscles, we have eccentrically oriented muscles, and what we want is joints that can move through their full excursion. And so if I can reorient or reduce the movement limitations just through pressure control and altering position of the pelvis and therefore the acetabulum itself, then I should see a change in hip mobility. Because again, if I have a retroverted if I have a retroverted acetabulum, I'm going to see some form of hip range of motion limitation. Mm-hmm. If I can provide the system more variability through whatever mechanism, whether I'm wiggling a joint with a mobilization or through respiration or through muscle activity, if I'm effective in restoring variability to that system, I should see the change in range of motion. So that's what you see as we go through. Now, it wasn't symmetrically gained, and so we go through a process. And so the way you measure and remeasure as you move through this process is going to guide your treatment as to where in this system you need to restore variability. So let's go back to the initial eval for a second, and we go back to that passive hip abduction measure, and I've got this asymmetrical capability in the frontal plane. You can see it. So our hip abduction was 50 on the left and 30 on the right. So I know I'm right lateralized. And as I provided her a stimulus that allowed her to restore variability in the sagittal plane, I still had a little bit of a frontal plane limitation. So I think about two exercises in, we saw hip internal rotation is 35 on the left and 20 on the right. So while it's improving, it wasn't perfect yet as far as what I'm assuming she is capable of. Mm-hmm. And again, it's an assumption on my part, right? So we move from a sagittally oriented activity to more of a frontal plane transverse plane activity, and then you saw the restoration of hip internal rotation on both sides, and you also saw the hip abduction measure basically restored to normal.
Right. Yeah, that's great. So, Bill, we're just about right out of time. Let's finish off our podcast interview today with a clinical pearl, something that maybe you found interesting or something that's helped you tremendously in regards to your process that young PTs or veteran PTs can take away from you.
I think the assumption, as we're measuring people, that they're somehow in some ideal position, and then when we see these movement limitations, that it's a local phenomenon is something that really needs to be understood a little bit more. We all will develop patterns and positions based on how the entire system interacts with the environment, with the task involved. And so we need to understand that when we see a limitation, it's not something we need to pull and yank on. It may just be the system that is defending itself against something or protecting itself against something. And then we need to provide a stimulus. And so then treat from a hierarchy. Okay, what can I do that affects the most systems and restore the most variability? And then work downward from there, from more of a systemic effect to a local effect. And I think if you can grasp that concept and then start to apply it, you're going to be much more successful.
That was an awesome clinical pearl. I think that's going to help a lot of people out there and kind of change their thought process. So, Bill, where can people find out more information about you?
IFAST University is a great place. We do some online education there, and that's from the fitness perspective, and some of the rehab stuff is there. And then BillHartman.net is my personal site. And so they can find me there. I'm also floating around all the social medias if you want to check me out there.
Perfect. Well, Bill, thanks again for taking the time to get on the podcast today. It was a pleasure having you.
I appreciate it, Scott.
Thank you for listening to Scott Gray's Redefining Physical Therapy podcast, the number one podcast for orthopedic, sport, and manual physical therapists.